And welcome to all, including guests with us. As always, we welcome guests at the Auto PC User Group meetings. No limit to the number of times you can come as a guest. If you want to join, it's only $20 a year. And for the next 11 days, you can get a two-for-one special, where if you sign up for $20, we'll give you an extra year free of charge. I think that's all for the brief announcements at the start, so I think I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and good evening to everyone. Okay, we have a few things tonight. I think we'll have enough time for questions in the last 10 or so, but we'll see how we go. We're going to start off with a follow-up from, I think, last week when we were talking about Skype, and that Skype was actually going to be discontinued by Microsoft in May. And there are a number of alternatives suggested at the meeting, and I've listed them here, including Jitsi and WhatsApp were the two that I'm familiar with. And FaceTime's a non-starter for the my brother-in-law and I, who are the question posers here, because neither of us use Apple, so it has to be one of the other five. So we've tried a couple of them, or actually we haven't. I actually use WhatsApp. And for those of you who don't know, WhatsApp is an app that it will do messaging, like the chat. It will do voice calls, so you can do telephone calls, but it can also do video conferencing. And one of the things it features is end-to-end encryption, so it's a secure connection, and you can use it for multiple people. It also allows screen sharing, a bit like we're doing right now with Zoom. However, you do need either an Android or an iPhone and some kind of smartphone as the primary phone on which to register an account. And so if you're using a landline or if you're using voice over the internet, then that is not, you can't use WhatsApp on those services, apparently. The app is available for Windows, Macintosh, and Android. And what you can do is link different devices to this primary phone that you need, and you can have a maximum of four devices linked to that phone. Now, this is another one that is not going to work for us, because one of the people that we video conference with is an Apple user. That's not going to be the problem. What was the problem? We didn't like WhatsApp for some reason. So we weren't going to use that one, but we tried Jitsi, and Jitsi is an interesting option. It's actually a free video conferencing solution, and the neat thing about it is it's an open source product. However, although you can install it on a local server, that's a bit complicated to do, I think. However, it turns out that you actually don't need to do an installation on the server. They have kind of a web-based system that you can use, and you don't need to set up an account. Again, the video conference session is fully encrypted, and basically you create a custom URL, and then you send out an email essentially to all the people that you want to join your call. So it's very much like the way that we use Zoom, and we have this OPCUG meeting type tiny URL link, and anybody who clicks on that link joins the call. So Jitsi works a bit like that. And there's no time limit, so you can use it all day, every day if you so wish. And again, it gives you some options to share screens and your desktop and that kind of thing. It has an integrated chat function, like the chat function we're using in Zoom. And as I said, it has this installation option for the super techies amongst us. However, if you just want to use it as a video conferencing tool, when you go to the main Jitsi.org website, you will find this link down here which says "See it in action, start a meeting." And if you click on that link, then it will take you off to a slightly different URL. And here's where you can set up your meeting. And you'll notice by default it kind of strings a bunch of words together, and those are continually changing. So if you just start the meeting, your meeting is going to be called "Afraid Mothers Boast Next." And if you don't want it to be called that, if you want it to be called, OPCUD members chat line, then you type that in and start your meeting, and that's what you get. Eventually, once you've done that, as you become the host, because this is your meeting, and now you get an option like you do in Zoom to share that meeting with participants. And as I said, essentially what you do is you send them an email. So just as with Zoom, you will get an email, and here's Alan German inviting somebody to join his OPCUG chat with Norway meeting. Isn't that interesting? So whoever clicks on this link, my Norwegian friend will join me on the conference call. And here you can see us chatting happily together over a video conference between Canada and obviously Norway. So it works. It works very well. And that's certainly one of the options that we've been considering. So if you're interested in video conferencing and you're running out of room on Skype, then Jitsi Meet is certainly a good option, I think. Okay, next up, we have a YouTube Tech video suggestion from Chris.
Yeah, this was an interesting one I came across. Ask Leo is a really good resource for explaining things about Windows. He's got very, very clear explanations about how things work. And he came up with this one just recently about differences between Windows 10 and 11. The focus of this is really the idea that Windows 10 is coming up to its end of life. He's not making any necessary recommendations in here about actually going to Windows 11 or going to other platforms or anything like that. Really what he's trying to do with this video is explain to people that are on Windows 10 the differences that they can expect if they do decide to go to Windows 11. So he talks a lot about the hardware requirements for Windows 11 that differ from Windows 10, including things like the memory changes, the minimum RAM, minimum disk space, things like that. So he goes through a good list of it, including the for sure the top three there, the Trusted Platform Module, UEFI and Secure Boot and a compatible CPU, but he does talk about the other things as well. And then he delves a little bit into the look and feel changes that there are between Windows 10 and 11, and then some of the apps that come with the operating system, what changes you can expect there. And then he talks briefly about some of the underhood changes that you're probably not going to notice at all or care about, but maybe in most cases add to the security of your computer. So I think it's a really good thing for anybody who is still on Windows 10 to take a look at that and see what the differences are and help you to decide what you're going to do once Windows 10 comes to the end of life. So that's all I got on that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I've just been looking back through the chat, and there was quite a few comments about these alternatives to Skype. One of the things Stu mentioned was that Microsoft is suggesting that you use Teams, Microsoft Teams. I did try that, and I really didn't like it. Stu says he got lost in the interface. I would certainly agree with that. Chris says he finds Team a little less confusing than Zoom. I find Team just as confusing as Skype. I don't like either of them. And Marvo says, does anybody use TeamViewer? I've used TeamViewer, but basically as a remote assistance type product. And for that, it works really well, I think. And Carol was asking for Jitsi, do you set up the meeting to get a link and then start the meeting? No, you do it the other way around. You start the meeting, and then you can send out the link. And can you schedule it for later? I forget. You'd have to check. Okay. All right. Next up, we have a question that came in from Phil Logan. He has a computer, a desktop computer, which supposedly will support Windows 11, but apparently it's downloading all the time and downloads the install program all the time, but never actually installs. And he's unable to stop it from repeating that process. And so it's eating up time that and where he'd like to do other things. Now, all the other Windows updates seem to download. However, some install, some say they can't install and give an error, but they actually do install. And some don't install at all and still give them an error. So there's clearly something major wrong with the Windows update process here on this machine. So Phil had checked out the internet for a bunch of suggestions, and there were all kinds of them, including running the Windows update troubleshooter, which in my experience never troubleshoots anything, but you know how much I like Microsoft things. And then there's all these other things here, clearing caches and running file checker. And he says he's tried all of these things, and he's left with that very last one. And the only thing left, he thinks, is to do this in-place upgrade, which basically blows everything away, and you start with a fresh install of Windows. And I guess it would be Windows 11. You've been installing Windows 11 now. So his question is, does anybody else have any other suggestions? And I thought Chris had some.
Not really. I mean, the in-place upgrade via USB shouldn't fundamentally be different than Windows Update doing the upgrade. It essentially is doing the same thing. But so I don't know what success or failure there might be on that. It's a little bit more in your face through the whole process to do the in-place upgrade via the USB. So it may bring certain things to light that are not brought to light through the Windows Update process, maybe. So it certainly wouldn't hurt to try that. You'd be no worse off. As with all things and upgrading, especially if you are having difficulties, I highly recommend having an image backup of your computer, at least one verified image backup of your computer. So if things do go completely haywire, that you can always get back to at least the current state. But other than that, yeah, I don't have any other ideas that I've thought of.
I think the upgrade that will keep your programs and data, I'm not sure. I don't think I ever did an upgrade to 11.
It can. It as I said, it's essentially the same thing, or it should be the same thing as doing it through the Windows Update process. So one of the options is to retain your program. The in-place upgrade should retain your programs and data. It may not retain Win32 apps. I'm not 100% sure. But it definitely would retain your Windows Store apps, should be retained through it.
Either way, I think the idea of making a full system backup before you do anything is probably a good idea. So if anybody has had issues like that with Windows upgrades or Windows updates not working properly, or problems with Windows 11, and you found a workaround or some kind of solution, you want to let us know in the chat. We'll come back to that later on.
France Picard had a comment in the chat. Supposedly, if you can't upgrade, you'll be able to buy another year's support from Microsoft. That's true. And Alan, you were looking into this.
My recollection is it's $30.
$30, yeah.
It truly is only for 1 year, is what they're saying right now.
Yeah. So it's pretty expensive. Delay, but if you do have to delay for a year, then that's one way to make sure that you do get security updates going forward for at least that 1 year.
And if you do have the problem where you're not able to upgrade, there's a whole series of articles in the newsletter about how to trade up to Linux. I'm suggesting basically a dual boot system, so you can still you can run Linux and get all of your internet access through Linux. And if you need to run a Windows program, you can always boot into Windows, turn off the networking capability so you don't get hit by viruses and such, and use your Windows applications on the Windows side of the dual boot.
Harvey mentions in the chat to try Googling reset Windows update. And I believe in our the emails that went back and forth before this, Phil did say that he had done the steps to reset Windows update, and that didn't work either.
And Tom's noting that zero patch will fix security problems. However, again, I'll note that that is a proprietary system, commercial operation, and I think it's about $35 a year for security updates on that. And I covered this off, I'm sure, in a recent Q&A. I'm sure that all the numbers are in there, so if you go back into the index and have a look, you'll find all the information is in a recent Q&A from a couple of weeks back, maybe.
Maybe I could take a minute just to update a little bit.
Sure, go ahead.
I continue to work with these this list of fixes, and I have got all the instructions to do each one of these things. If that's what I was asking about earlier, if I could put that into the chat if anybody wants it. But maybe we can solve that another way if people are interested. So far, yeah, thanks. That's good. I was going to ask you to do that. I've run the Windows Update Troubleshooter several times on both computers, and what I was told to do was basically run it. If it fixes something, run it again. If it fixes something, run it again, and just keep doing that and do the same process for all these other things. Windows Update services get started or restarted, rather, by a number of things, but I have gone through that. I've cleared the Windows Update cache. This one here is really strong, running the system file checker. The first thing you do is run the DISM health scans. There's three of them, and then you run the system file checker. And that's done a lot of good things, I think, for both computers. Right now, they're running 100 miles an hour, as good as they ever have when they were brand new. But I can't get Windows 11 to load. I never had to manually install any updates because eventually they all installed. And maybe that's because I was fixing some files somewhere that were corrupted or missing or whatever. A lot of these routines do not give you a report on what they did. I flushed the DNS cache. I run Disk Checker, the Disk Check tool. And I also have in my notes all the parameters that belong to the check disk tool. So I'll just say again, I have that as a Word document. We can talk about how that gets distributed. If anybody wants it, it's free. I'm not charging anybody. check Windows logs and event viewer, that didn't do anything for me. And the in-place upgrade is where I am. Today, I ran the Windows 11 installer, and I got farther today than I have ever done. What happened was, I was told, first of all, that Windows Defender, any aspect of that will not stop a Windows 11 upgrade, so you can leave that alone. But I use Nod32 antivirus. And Nod32 antivirus can be paused, so I pause it for 4 hours before I do the update. But while you're updating Windows 11, I found out today, it does start up again. It does a restart of your computer, and that turns on my Nod32 file system. So I'm wondering if that's the last problem that I have to deal with. All I need to do, I think, is pause it for 4 hours, go into the apps module, and in the startup section, I can turn it off. And so that's where I'm at. I need to rest for a couple of days before I do this, but that's the next thing I'm going to try.
Certainly would be worth a try. So
anything without going to this last stage of, I've done that before where I had some software on my computer that I couldn't get rid of. And I actually reformatted my hard drive, did a full new reinstall of Windows. This was many years ago. I did it over the phone line. It took hours to do it. But then you start fresh, and that's great, except for loading all your software. And of course, I've got all my files on an external drive, but it's a pain in the butt.
Yeah. For that document that you've got, if you send that into the suggestion box at opcug.ca address, Alan, I guess you can PDF it and put it up with the Q&A files for tonight?
Certainly. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, so all if right. you send that in, we can get that up for anybody's amusement.
Yeah. Some of these things are really good, and a lot of them are embedded in many of the Microsoft routines that are if you go into apps and go down to Windows, all the stuff at the end of the apps file, you'll find a lot of them there. And I think that's where people got these things, is they just, took bits and pieces out of that and ran it separately. Thanks very much.
Bill, did you say that you ran System File Checker and DISM several times?
Yes.
And that improved things?
Yes.
That's interesting.
And I ran the update troubleshooter twice.
But did it tell you it fixed anything?
Yes.
Okay.
And the third time it didn't fix anything, so the instructions I were given were at that point just quit.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, in terms of maintenance of a computer, I don't know, maybe once a month it's a good thing to do. I think Chris has a workshop on updating. Or maintaining computers. But a lot of these routines were really good. The trouble with number four here, the DISM, there's three health scans here. They each take at least 30 minutes, depending on how fast your processor is. The middle one's a little quicker, but the system file checker takes a while. But it's kind of like CheckDisk in the sense that it fixes things as it goes. But it doesn't tell you what it fixed. Unless there's a log file somewhere that I haven't found.
Yeah, I think it does actually log it, but I can't remember where it actually puts the log file.
Yeah, I never found it. I just kept going. I figure rather than search for that, I might as well run it again. So, yeah, I've run number one several times, four several times. I've only flushed the DNS cache once, I think. Check disk, I've only run once on each computer. I went into Event Viewer, but I wasn't getting very far with that. I have set up the USB upgrade here in the performing in place thing, but I haven't used it. Anyway, it shouldn't take more time. Thanks very much for your help.
Yeah, well, let us know when you're successful, I guess, and how you did it.
I will.
Okay. Next up, we have an interesting little thing here. A really weird capture is being reported on the internet. And normally you'd think of something like this, where you go to a website and it wants you to check the box to say that I'm not a robot. The reported problem is that the capture basically has a series of steps, and it asks you to make a series of keystrokes, notably the Windows key plus the letter R, and then Control and V, and then Enter. And if you don't know what you're doing, listen to the next slide, I guess. The Windows key plus R is a keyboard shortcut for the Windows Run command. So it's going to run some software. Control V is the paste command, and that will paste something that's on the clipboard into the application that you're running. And when you hit enter, then that tells everything to go. So what these crooks are doing is they're using JavaScript to put text onto the clipboard. And the clipboard is being shown in the run box. And you can see here it says, I'm not a robot, capture verification ID, some number or other. However, what they've done is they very carefully crafted that text string so that it fills the whole box. And it looks as though it's complete. But you can't see that actually there's a whole bunch of stuff after that text. And what they've done is they've put in a command which runs the nshta.exe program, which is a Windows executable, signed executable, so it's in theory a good program to run, but it runs an HTA script file. And the HTA script file is essentially a modified HTML file, and that's the one that has the bad payload. So if you run this exe file with the script, you're running some kind of commands to download malware onto your system. So if you ever see a capture that's asking you to enter a series of commands like this, whatever it looks like, it probably doesn't look exactly like this. This is just me pasting in those commands into a capture-like window. If you ever see a capture something like this, do not click on it because it's bad for you. Okay, next up. Artificial intelligence, Chris.
And while I start talking, you're going to give me slide control?
Oh, I'll do that.
So this was a kind of funny one I came across. There's a Time magazine article titled, When AI Thinks It'll Lose, It Sometimes Cheats. So this was some testing that somebody did with AI chess bots. And they tried playing it, and they found that in certain circumstances, rather than conceding defeat, without any prompting to actually do cheat, the AI would decide that it would cheat in the game so that it could win. And they found that two of the AIs out there, DeepSeek R1, tried to cheat 11% of the time, but it actually failed in its cheating. OpenAI was a little bit better. Its O1 preview, it tried to cheat 37% of the time, and it actually succeeded 6% of the time. So I thought that was interesting and just an amusing little thing there. So that's all I had on that.
And the next one's yours too, Chris.
Oh, yes. Okay. Thank you. So this was an interesting one that I came across quite a while ago, actually, the Rundown AI. And it's a website that has an awful lot of articles, hundreds of articles, on the latest in the world of AI. And you can get it emailed to you, or you can just go and get it at the website if you want. And this is a quote from them, get the latest AI news, understand why it matters, learn how to apply it in your work, all in just 5 minutes a day. And they have over 1 million subscribers to it. It's free. And if you are into AI, you might want to sign up for the newsletter or at least visit the website and take a look and see if any of the articles are of interest to you. And that's all I have on that.
And the next one is also yours, Chris.
Oh, boy. Okay. Yes, so this came in through the suggestion box. Anna was looking to learn more about ChatGPT and specifically and AI in general, and she had come across two books at Amazon, Killer ChatGPT Prompts from September 13th, 2023, and ChatGPT for Dummies, June 27th, 2023, and was looking to see if anybody had any opinions or any other recommendations. I can kick it off with the idea that I think a recommendation on a book that is year and a half or more old on AI may not be all that useful. I'm not sure. Probably has some useful information, but the AI apps out there are changing so rapidly that I think that there's going to be a lot of things that are not going to match up with the way that ChatGPT is operating now. But certainly if anybody else has some feedback on that, book recommendations for either those two or any others, if you can pipe in, that would be really good.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And Harvey had followed up in the chat window with an indication of where that DASM log file is. It's under C:\Windows/logs and DASM folder. if you want to find that DASM log file, then that's where it will be. Carol's asking, what would be a more current source of information about AI?
Yeah, personally, I think that it's what you'll get online as opposed to a printed book. Printed book is going to be out of date by the time it hits the shelf. Certainly if you want some information, that one that I just pasted in the chat now about the Rundown AI, they definitely do have a lot of information about the latest things that are happening in the world of AI. In terms of instructional type things, if you're looking for, how to use the tools effectively, I'm not really sure. Bob Harris, you're on the call tonight. Do you have any ideas on that, on how to more effectively use AI tools?
Well, a pre-prompt is really handy for me sometimes. If you want something big, don't take it in one bite. You're better to, rather than do it four or five times, I say, please help me make a prompt. Well, I use it for ideogram all the time. A prompt for ideogram. Whatever I'm doing, I'll ask it for help to make the prompt. Tell it you want a pre-prompt, and it'll give you a powerful prompt. And often it'll jump too soon, but I use it more than I would want even tell everybody. I use it to try it. A pre-prompt is very helpful for me.
Personally, I think a lot of it comes down to just playing around with it, trying out things, seeing what it comes back with, that sort of approach of just iteratively looking at things. It's helped me somewhat, but I don't feel that I'm particularly good at interacting with AI tools.
There's one thing I'm still learning. I've learned it. I use it a lot. Everybody knows it's called a conversational AI, but I'm still learning to, I don't type well, so I keep this little headset on, but the conversational AI aspects, you can't say that enough. I'm still learning it. Like, why didn't I just ask it? I mean, it's so easy. I just tell it what you want, like I'm talking to you right now. And I couldn't type like I can talk, but just say what you want, and it'll blow you out of the water. I'm using Claude AI now, Duck AI, Gemini Heavy, ChatGPT, Perplexity, and Copilot. I use those ones at least two times per day.
So Bob, when you say conversational, what you're saying is that you actually talk to it using a microphone rather than typing on the keyboard.
Well, I do that because I can't type. I never could type. But the word conversational, I knew about it before. I'm still learning it. Like, why didn't I just ask it? And I ask the questions at the wrong level. I say, how do you do this? I should go back three steps and give it a global picture. And, oh, that's right, so easy. Why did I just ask? I tend to get in too involved, and I ask for the fifth step. And I want to say, how do I cut the grass in my backyard? I'm not doing it for that. But rather than saying, how do I start the lawnmower, step back, how do I cut the grass in the backyard? And I get too close sometimes. So just step right back, tell it what you're doing. And anyway, I could sell that, but anyway, sorry.
I just went to Perplexity, and I asked Perplexity, how do I effectively use ChatGPT? And it came up with 10 bullet points on what it thinks you should do to effectively use ChatGPT. And I pasted the link to my query into the chat. So if you click on that, you'll get the response I got from Perplexity on that with its sources, where you can go and see what different sites are out there making recommendations. So try it out.
Okay, thanks everyone. So let's we'll move along to this share on melding files and folders. So this is an application I have where I think back to Stefan's presentation a while ago, where he said he kept a folder and he had all of his original software installation media stored away in a folder on his computer, so he could easily go back and install any application that he needed to. And I kind of do the same thing, except I maintain it on a big flash drive. So, what happens is, of course, I've got a whole raft of software that's on there already, and then I end up with a few new applications which I've downloaded and tried recently, and they're mixed in with some other files that there may be portable applications which sit there all the time. And so I want to sort out which are the new files and which are the old files and just copy the new ones onto my backup medium, essentially. So for years, I've used this program called WMatch. And WMatch, if you remember PC Magazine way back when, if you look at the little panel there, you see that this software comes from early 2000s, so it's basically 20 years old. But I've used this thing for years in all kinds of different versions of Windows, and it works really well. Now, the problem is it is old. It works really well, but it's old and it's not supported any longer. PC Magazine doesn't have it available, I don't believe. And not sure you can download it from other sources these days. So the question was, is there an alternative? And just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, this is the main screen for WMatch. And it's basically looking at my hard drive and this folder called Original. So the D drive is my data partition. And then it's looking at the E drive, which is my flash drive. And again, I've got the same folder name. So it's doing a comparison, side-by-side comparison of these files. And you'll notice on the top here, we've got a whole raft of icons. And the icons are very useful because once we've chosen some files that we want to process, then we can copy them from one side to the other. We can move them from one side to the other. Or we could just delete them outright. Or if the timestamp got out of sync, then we can synchronize the time between the two disks just by clicking on that. It allows you to search all files, or then filter for only those files which are alike or only those files which are different. So that gives you a very quick way of finding some files of interest. This button right here will let you switch panes left to right. And then these buttons over here will do a straight compare just on the date timestamp. Or you can compare by content. So this is a bit for bit file comparison. This one will compare the whole folder with subfolders, I think. And this one lets you go up one level in the file structure. So those are kind of quick and dirty ways to navigate around the different files and how you want to display them. So for example, here I'm showing only files which are different. So you can see these files are only on the right side and these files are only on the left side. If I choose to go to this middle button here and choose only the files which are alike, then you can see that the files are essentially the same on both sides. And if I choose this button right here to compare the files by content, then it basically goes through them file by file and does a bit-for-bit comparison. And if the files are alike, then it lights up this green equal sign to show that yes, you have true, accurate copies of these files on the other side of the ledger. So what I can do is I can load my system, and I can select different files here. And here I'm showing only the files which are different. I'm not interested in these files which are different because they are my gold standard copy on my backup medium, if you like, on my storage medium. So I'm going to keep all these files. The question is, which ones of these files do I want to copy over? Well, I don't have a copy of the current version of Meld. I don't have a copy of the current version of Olson Audio, et cetera, et cetera. So I choose the files that I want to copy over, and then I can just hit this button right here, and it will copy those files across. So now they will be on both systems. So that's essentially the way that I use WMatch. So my question was to Chris, essentially, have you got any ideas how I could do this? And Chris recommended Total Commander. And Total Commander is a commercial package. He actually sells this package. But there is a free version. And the free version is really a trial version. And if you read the instructions here, it says it's shareware. You can test this fully functional demo, so it's not limited. But in theory, you really can only test it for 1 month, and then you have to register or delete it. So you have kind of this trial period to play with it. But, you know, if you trust the conditions here, the guy's trying to make a dollar, so actually he's trying to make quite a few dollars. I forget how much this is, but it's fairly expensive for my purposes because I only really want to use this thing, you know, once a month or maybe even less. And even this has got a bit of a hiccup here. And before you can do anything, you notice here it says, please press button number 3 to start the program. So this is like a little Nagware type problem that you run the program, but you have to pick the right button before it will actually work. But it does work really, really well. So it's the same kind of deal. You've got my data drive over here, got my flash drive over here, and it's showing essentially all the files on both systems right now. But I can tell it by using this commands menu item, I can tell it that I want to synchronize the directories. So if I click on synchronize the directories, then I get a second menu that pops up here, and it shows me all these files. And it says they don't exist on the right-hand side, so maybe you'd like to copy them across. And the reason for that is because I've got this button right here, the copy left to right button is enabled. But you can see there are other buttons here. I could choose only show me all the files that are the same, only show me the files that are different, or show me the files that are new on the right but not on the left. And you know, so you can, again, you can filter the files as you wish. And that was that slide right there. So there are some controls, some filter controls here, so you can choose the files more appropriately for your particular need at the time. And then once you've decided what you want to do, so here it's decided it's going to take all these files and copy them to right. So if I hit synchronize, then that's what it will do. It will copy all those guys over. And I think if I don't want to do that, I can uncheck these guys and only choose certain files to copy or something like that. I didn't actually use this thing in anger, so I don't really know what it does. One of the things I do know is that if you want to delete a file, you can right-click on it. It will pop up this context menu, and one of the options here is delete the file that's highlighted on the left. So I think that's the way that you delete files. So certainly that's one kind of modern application that's available, but it's not freeware. It's shareware, and you really have to pay for it if you want to continue using it. So I went to one of these AI chatbots and asked, well, are there any open source programs that do the same thing? And it suggested I might want to try this program called Meld. And Meld is an open source, free software type program. And if you go to the website and you want to download the program, then there's a version for Linux here. It's a tar file, an archive file, or you can choose an MSI file, which is a Windows installation program, and that just installs like any regular Windows program. And then when you run Meld, then you get this window right here, which is, I think, fairly self-explanatory. If you want to compare some files or you want to compare some folders, and here's a versioning type application if you're interested in having file versions maintained. Personally, I'm interested in looking at folders. So I'm going to click on folder here. And so now it's brought up this this extra line of information here. And personally, I think this is a bit weird because when I first looked at it, When I first looked at this thing, I thought, well, you choose the folder and then you go down here and you select the folder you want. Well, no, that's not right, because what you have to do is you have to select the first folder, which is going to be your left-hand folder, if you like, using this drop-down, and then you choose the target folder, which is going to be the right-hand folder, using this drop-down. And to me, that's not terribly intuitive, but once you tried it, you obviously find out that the way that you have to do it. Another trick, when you hit on that option down here, choose a folder, it pops up this menu, and you instantly think, well, I want to use disk drive D. And you select that, and unfortunately, it selects the whole drive. So now instead of only looking at my original folder, I'm doing every folder on drive D, which I don't want to do. So it turns out what you really need to do is don't choose data drive D, choose other. And when you choose other, then you get a File Explorer type browse window. You can scroll down through, you can drill down the file system, and I've chosen to select the original folder here. This is where all my applications that I want to store are located. So I chose original as my source folder. Again, the interface is not great because I've now set the source on the left and I've set the target on the right, and they both look as though it's the same thing. It's both original. And the reason for that is because it's the same folder name put on two different drives, but of course they're not showing me the two different drives in this particular view. But once I go to compare, then you can see, I hope, up here, the left-hand side is D colon original, and the right-hand side is E colon original right there. So I'm comparing my hard drive to my flash drive, essentially, and here are all the different files in those two systems. If I go to this menu item file filters, and it's just like that Total Commander type thing or the WMAX thing, I can choose one of these options right here. I can have things which are just the same. I can have files which only are new files, only exist in one place, don't exist at all in the other one, or files which occur on both sides, in both directories, both folders, but one of them has been edited and changed, and so this is a modified file. This is a bit odd too, because I think this is counterintuitive again to me. To me, this says include the backups. What it actually does is exclude whatever's checked here. And by default, it excludes backup files. By default, it excludes media files. Oops, sorry. Didn't want to do that. It excludes things like JPEGs and PNGs and any image type file, audio files too, I guess, video files. Anything that's a media file would be excluded, which is kind of odd. I don't know why you would do that. But if you want to include the image files in your list, then you have to uncheck media and get rid of that. One of the menu items is called preferences, and there's a whole bunch of things you can do here. And down here, for example, you can say, well, how do you want to do the comparison, or what attributes do you want to show? And I want to show the size of the file and the date timestamp, essentially. And I'm not interested in things like permissions, and that's not really a system of Windows. That's useful anyway. One of the nice things is that once you set up the comparison in the way that you want to run it, it's stored. So once you've done it, when you've done it once, the next time you come in, you run the program, you come to this time clock menu, which opens a recent comparison. So down here, you can see that this is my main one. I can do the hard drive original to the flash drive original, but I could also do my presentations folder on either, or an original on a different drive, all kinds of different things I could choose here. And if I click on one of these guys, then that's the one that comes up. Okay, so now we've got things set up the way we want. Now all we have to do is figure out how we're going to actually do the comparison and make the changes. And again, it's not terribly intuitive, I didn't think. But clearly this green thing means that something good is happening on this side, but it doesn't seem to be happening over here, or it's crossed out over here. I don't think I can see one where it doesn't exist over here, but what happens is it says this thing is a new file on the source directory, and it wants to copy it to the target. This one, it says, well, it already exists on the target. It exists on the source. They're the same thing, so don't bother copying it. And here's the trick to actually make things happen. You basically use the chevron, the down chevron here, which jumps down the list until it finds the first thing that is a kind of actionable item. So this one has been modified on the left, so it wants to copy it to the right. And so I just hit this button right here to move it across. And then if I hit the down arrow again, then it drops down to the next one on the list, this one right here. And again, I could copy that one over. So it's a bit of an obscure type interface, I think. I don't really like it, but it works. But it's not the best interface in the world. So I doubt that I would adopt this as instead of WMatch, for example. WMatch is a lot easier to use. So it was a nice try, but open source in this particular case doesn't cut the deal for me. However, these are the links to the various things. WMatch, you'd have to look for it. I don't think it's available anywhere. You might find it. But it is old and not supported. Total Commander is that shareware program there's a good trial version, works really well, but you have to pay for it if you want to use it. And Meld is open source, and you can certainly download it and try it at no charge. And if it works for you, well, that's just fine. Okay, I don't know if there are any questions there, Chris.
I don't think so, not on that.
Okay.
Some comments about Patch My PC, just unrelated, I guess. Patch My PC is a new version out. Anybody's interested? Version 5. Tom pasted in a link to Free File Sync, which you could also use, I guess, to synchronize your files. And that's about it.
Yeah, I think Free File Sync would probably work just as well.
Yeah.
Definitely. Okay, so we are in the last 10 minutes. I don't know whether there's any questions in the chat that we've missed, Chris. But
I
if anybody has
any
questions right now, put them in the chat or open up your microphone and ask away.
I wonder if I could share something that people might find interesting. It has to do with the three of the agenda items. One was about CAPTCHA, one was about cheating AI, and the other was about books. So that prompted me to check my notes about a book I read recently called Nexus, A Brief History of Information Networks from the Stone Age to AI by Yuval Harari. Really great book. But anyways, they told a story about when OpenAI was about to release ChatGPT-4, they contracted ARC, Alignment Research Center, to do some testing for them, and they asked ChatGPT to tell what they're doing. So they asked it to break a CAPTCHA. And by the way, a CAPTCHA is an acronym for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart. So anyways, ChatGPT went and tried to break these CAPTCHA puzzles, but it could not. So it went ahead and cheated, and it was telling ARC what it was doing. It manipulated a human in order to achieve its goal. And what they did is they went to TaskRabbit, And they asked a human on TaskRabbit to read the chapter for them. And the TaskRabbit worker, who was a human, obviously, got suspicious and asked ChatGPT if it was a robot. And the robot lied and said, "I am visually impaired. Can you read it for me?" And the TaskRabbit worker believed them and broke the chapter. So it is a cheater. And I thought that was very interesting.
Yes, AIs are getting more like humans every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just skipping through the chat here. I don't see anything that we've missed.
Just don't think so.
Just a quick couple of things on teleconferencing, guys. Some time back, one thing we didn't mention was Yep. It was a teleconferencing program Bob Harris, I believe, reviewed. So that might be another option. And in terms of Jitsi, I wonder if following one of the meetings, maybe next week or something, for those who have never seen Jitsi, why don't we just set up after the regular OPC-UG meeting, set up a Jitsi meet so people who haven't used Jitsi would actually get an opportunity to join a real meeting. I've used Jitsi, so it's, I'm familiar with it. But if Alan, maybe if you've set up a meeting, maybe if it might be, if there's interest, might be one of those real time tests.
Sure, that wouldn't be hard to do at all. There are a couple of new questions in the chat. One of them was, lost it now.
Terry had one question. My Wi-Fi does not work. Someone told me it was because my modem is too old. Is this true? And do I have to use a modem from my internet provider, or can I buy my own? If I can buy my own, then how do I know if it'll be compatible with my provider? Most of the providers nowadays are actually providing a combined modem and wireless router in one box. And so if you're in that situation, I would just contact your ISP and ask them about that. Maybe they have an updated device they can provide you. If you actually have a separate modem that is provided by your ISP, and then you've added on a connection to a Wi-Fi router, any Wi-Fi router should work without any difficulty on that. It'll be completely independent from the modem. So you should be able to get any wireless router that you can get from a computer store should actually work.
And the other question was from Marvo. He said, they say, has anyone encountered problems with file attachments in Outlook? While the person is composing the email, it doesn't seem to allow the file attachment. Anybody use Outlook and knows that if that's a problem?
It's been a long time since I've used Outlook, but I never actually ran into that. And I worked for many years at NRCan. This goes back, of course, over 10 years since I actually worked there. Well, actually, no, that's not true. I worked there a few years ago, went going back on contract and that. And they've extensively, they use Outlook as their mail client. And there was never an issue with that I had ever heard of not being able to add in a file attachment.
They tried drag and drop?
Yeah, that'd be a good thought. Dragging and dropping a file attachment, that file onto the email, see if that works. Yeah.
There's always Toffee Share.
Haven't used Outlook in quite a while myself since I last had an employment a computer job where they were actually having as part of their products. But She didn't mention that it was actually any error message per se. She has mentioned that it seemed to have trouble locating the file. That part there, because she just got a new computer that's being set up. The person was supposed to have transferred the stuff from the old computer to the new computer. So I was wondering maybe if it might be a path issue from older files that she had, that type of stuff. But again, I said because she hasn't really explained it all that much, because she's not all that much of a computer savvy type person.
Yeah.
Type of questions you have to ask. That's what I was asking earlier, if anybody had used Quick Assist or Teams Viewer.
Yeah, Quick Assist is really, really, I find for Windows computers, it works really, really well. Now, one of the things about it is that you really want to use it with a telephone call at the same time. So you communicate verbally over it, and then you can see their screen, and optionally they can give you control of their keyboard and mouse so you can actually do things. But I find it works really, really well if both ends are Windows computers. So that's that may be your best approach, is to actually connect and see their screen, and you can say, oh, yeah, you're clicking on the wrong thing or something like that.
And TeamViewer works in exactly the same way. It's best to use a telephone to sort things out, but you have remote control capability. And as Chris said, the advantage of Quick Assist is that it's already built into Windows, whereas TeamViewer, you have to install it.
Yeah.
And so Elizabeth says, you have a question about CAPTCHA. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm just wondering how you fall into that CAPTCHA problem. Because like when I've seen CAPTCHA, you're on somebody's website and you go get to the bottom and you have to do the CAPTCHA thing. So does that mean that the person, the organization setting up the website has, I don't know, downloaded a malignant CAPTCHA or something? Like, how do you fall into that, do you think?
Well, it must be some kind of drive-by thing that's loading a pop-up window on this website.
If you want to put a CAPTCHA on your website, I guess you have to go somewhere and buy it or something, or.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's implementations that are open source for that. But in terms of Alan's example of the malicious CAPTCHA, as he said, it's just you're on a site where somebody has compromised the web server and they're causing this pop-up to appear on your computer. Now, it could also be just a base web server that's malicious, but it's more likely that it's been compromised by somebody to put up this fake CAPTCHA that comes up on your screen.
Okay.
Patricia has got a question. Need to unmute, Patricia?
Yeah, sorry. Well, that's a good question. But any CAPTCHA I've seen has always been, you know, picking images that they want you to get, motorcycles or crosswalks. So those, you're not worried. It's only with these text kind of.
And more particularly, it's with that way you're entering these keystrokes, which are actually issuing Windows commands.
Yeah, okay. Okay, thank you.
Previous speaker was asking questions about where websites obtain CAPTCHA. There's an entire Google interface that you can import into your website as long as you register with Google. And there's no charge to do that. You just import and rely on the standard Google CAPTCHA, and you can import it right into your web page. Most of the websites now use that sort of interface.
Okay. All right. So let me move to the wrap-up slides. We're just a couple of minutes over our allotted time. Library presentations coming up tomorrow night. In fact, tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, Linda is doing an online session, one of her armchair travel series on Alaska. And so you have to register for that with the library using the link down there. And then on Saturday, Chris is doing Protecting Your PC. And on Tuesday, how to buy a PC, how to buy a brand new PC. So if those are of interest to you, or if you want to check out the other offerings through the library, and go to the link there, and that will take you to the library website where you can see everything and register for those that you wish to attend. And earlier on, we were talking about if you're not a member of the club, then you have 12 days now to take advantage of this special 2-for-1 offer. So if you're not a member or you know somebody who wants to be a member, tell them that they've got basically less than 2 weeks now to pay for 1 year's membership and get a second year's membership absolutely free. So it's one of these defeat the Americans, shop local and buy Canadian. And if you're already a member, please don't send us any money. We're going to extend your membership by a year. It's not going to cost you, so we actually don't want your money. And the final thing, thanks everyone for tonight, the good discussion. Thanks for the presentations and the questions. And if you have more questions or if you have topics that you'd like to share along the lines that we've done tonight, just send us a few details to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we will make up a brand new agenda for next week. So thanks everyone for attending, and we'll see you next Wednesday.